Sandy Hook families. And the Trump Supreme Court decision on immunity is imminent. Where might that go? All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Don't miss it. Make sure you're signed up at joinpacman.com. And we'll be back tomorrow with a new show as well.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
CT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Welcome, everybody. Hope you had a good weekend. One of the nice things we got going into the weekend was another very strong jobs report. And when you see job creation exceed expectations, and when you see a sustained low unemployment rate, if you're rooting for the country, if you're rooting for workers, if you're rooting for small businesses and the people, you would be happy about such news. You would say, oh, I'm on the side of my country and the people who work here. And therefore, when job creation is strong, when unemployment is low, it's something to be happy about. I know this would be sort of like a weird introduction to a story. if there were not a group of people actively rooting for the country's demise, or when they can no longer do that because it's so obvious the economy looks pretty good, they start taking credit for it despite the fact that they are not in power. And this is much of what we see from the modern Republican Party and particularly from the MAGA right.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Après avoir procédé aux consultations prévues.
After having proceeded with the consultations as provided in Article 12 of our Constitution, I decided to give back to you the choice for the future of our Parliament with a vote. And so I am dissolving tonight our National Assembly.
President Emmanuel Macron dissolves the French Parliament, calls for snap elections following major gains by the far right in France and across Europe. We'll get the latest. Then, with nearly 85,000 people wounded in Gaza, its healthcare system is barely functioning after coming under direct attack by Israel. We'll speak with an emergency medical doctor who just left Gaza. And we'll be joined by Jewish American Army Major Harrison Mann. He's the first military and intelligence officer to publicly resign over the Biden administration's support for Israel's war on Gaza.
I started my resignation in November because even then, in the first weeks of the war, it was really clear that the Israelis were prepared to inflict massive numbers of civilian casualties, that their conduct of the war, including the killing of civilians, was going to provoke a violent response.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hamas has accepted a United Nations Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. The U.S.-supported resolution passed Monday on a vote of 14-0 after Russia abstained. Its passage came after the Biden administration vetoed three previous resolutions calling for a ceasefire. Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations, Riyad Mansour, called the resolution a step in the right direction and demanded a permanent ceasefire.
Our position has been always to have an immediate ceasefire to stop the killing of our people. So this resolution is a step in that direction. The proof is in the details, and we want to see that this resolution to be implemented beginning with the ceasefire, and that this ceasefire to be permanent. We do not want to see the continuation of the fighting.
In a statement, Hamas said it would accept the ceasefire resolution and was ready to work with mediators to engage in indirect negotiations with Israel. Top U.S. officials have said Israel would accept the plan, contradicting statements by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Meanwhile, there's been no let-up in Israel's assault. Following the resolution's passage, Israeli attacks have killed at least 11 people in northern and central Gaza. This all comes as world leaders and top aid officials are gathered in Jordan for an emergency humanitarian summit on Gaza. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas are attending the summit. Israel was reportedly not invited. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces raided the Al-Fara refugee camp Monday, killing at least three people, including a 15-year-old Palestinian teenager named Mahmoud al-Nabrisi. This is a resident of the Al-Fara camp.
They raided the house and damaged everything, and the house and the ceiling, everything. They ruined the washer and refrigerator, the bathroom, not leaving anything in it. They are terrorists and do not care for anyone.
Israeli forces have also arrested multiple children in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem in recent days. Since October 7th, Israel's killed over 530 Palestinians in the West Bank and arrested over 9,000. Here in the U.S., a federal court heard arguments Monday in an appeal to a lawsuit accusing top Biden administration officials of complicity in genocide. The case at the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals was brought by Palestinians and human rights groups, including Defense for Children International Palestine. The suit seeks to end U.S. military and diplomatic support for Israel during its assault on the Gaza Strip. It names as defendants President Joe Biden, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. Monday's oral arguments were presented by Katie Gallagher, a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Your Honor, what this case presents is a clear allegation, a well-pled allegation of violations of binding law. The duty to prevent genocide and aiding and abetting genocide. Those are clearly established in law.
In California, police arrested more than 20 peace activists Monday evening as they staged a protest at the campus of the University of California, Los Angeles. The violent arrest came after students held a funeral procession for the more than 37,000 Palestinians killed by Israel's assault. This comes just days ahead of UCLA's commencement, when scores of student protesters facing disciplinary hearings may be prohibited from joining graduation ceremonies, and just weeks after campus police and security officers refused to intervene as pro-Israel counter-protesters armed with sticks, metal rods, and fireworks attacked students at a Gaza peace encampment. A federal jury in Florida has ordered Chiquita Brands International to pay over $38 million in damages to the families of eight Colombian men who were killed by paramilitaries that the banana giant funded. Chiquita previously pleaded guilty to paying the far-right United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia paramilitary group, or AUC, $1.7 million from 2001 to 2004, which Chiquita argued it did to protect its workers. The AUC has been found responsible for committing mass human rights abuses and murdering civilians from 1997 to 2006. Earth Rights International, which helped represent the plaintiffs, said in a statement, quote, "This verdict sends a powerful message to corporations everywhere. Profiting from human rights abuses will not go unpunished. These families, victimized by armed groups and corporations, asserted their power and prevailed in the judicial process," they said. Belgium's prime minister has formally resigned following a surge of support for far-right candidates on Sunday when Belgian voters cast ballots in general, regional and European elections. The right-wing anti-immigrant New Flemish Alliance will lead negotiations to form a coalition government in Belgium. This came as part of a wave of gains by Eurosceptic and far-right parties in EU elections over the weekend. We'll have more on those elections and the rise of the far-right in France after headlines. Newly published audio reveals Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito questioning whether the United States can overcome its polarized political divide and appearing to endorse a Christian theocracy. Justice Alito made the comments at the annual dinner of the Supreme Court Historical Society June 3rd. The audio was secretly recorded by documentarian Lauren Windsor, who posed as a conservative activist. In the recording, Justice Alito agrees when Windsor says she hopes to, quote, return our country to a place of godliness. And Alito appears to rule out compromise between polarized political factions.
One side or the other is going to win. I don't know. I mean, there can be a way of living together peacefully, but it's difficult, you know, because there are differences on fundamental things that really can't be compromised. They really can't be compromised. So it's not like we're going to split the difference.
In a separate recording from the same event, Justice Alito's wife, Martha Ann Baumgardner, complains about rainbow flags during Pride Month, quotes at length from the Bible, assails feminists as feminazis, and boasts of her German heritage. In May, Justice Alito told Congress he will not recuse himself from cases involving Donald Trump and the January 6th Capitol insurrection after photos emerged of two flags associated with election deniers flying in front of his homes in Virginia and New Jersey. Donald Trump sat for a virtual interview Monday with a New York probation officer ahead of his July 11th sentencing for his conviction on 34 felony counts of conspiring to interfere with the 2016 election. In other Trump news, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee held an outdoor Las Vegas rally Sunday at temperatures soaring over 100 degrees in the desert city. Trump joked to his supporters they should not die before they're able to vote for him.
Nice. Do you feel the breeze? Because I don't want anybody going on me. We need every voter. I don't care about you. I just want your vote. I don't care.
Six rally goers had to be taken to a hospital. Another two dozen received on-site medical attention due to the intense heat. Meanwhile, in Arizona, Rudy Giuliani was booked and posted a $10,000 bond in the Arizona criminal case involving the use of fake electors to overturn Trump's 2020 loss. Jury deliberations are underway in Hunter Biden's gun trial. The president's son is accused of illegally purchasing a gun at a time when he was using drugs. Hunter Biden's defense team argued he was in recovery and not a drug user at the time. If convicted, he could face up to 25 years in prison, though would likely receive a much lighter sentence. And the Reverend James Lawson has died at the age of 95. Lawson was a godfather of the civil rights movement, whom Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once called the leading theorist and strategist of nonviolence in the world. During the Korean War in the 50s, James Lawson was imprisoned for refusing to be drafted into the U.S. Army. He was later expelled from Vanderbilt University Divinity School for helping to organize lunch counter sit-in protests against segregation. As a missionary in India, Lawson studied Mahatma Gandhi's principles of nonviolence. He would go on to teach nonviolent civil disobedience tactics to rank-and-file activists in the civil rights movement. In 2020, Reverend Lawson was among speakers at the funeral of Congressmember John Lewis at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta.
We will not be quiet. As long as our nation continues to be the most violent culture in the history of humankind, we will not be quiet. As long as our economy is shaped not by freedom, but by plantation capitalism that continues to cause domination and control rather than access and liberty and equality for all.
To see our interview with Reverend James Lawson, you can go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
In Europe, residents of 27 countries went to the polls this weekend for the European Union's parliamentary elections. With nearly 400 million eligible voters, the EU elections are among the world's biggest democratic polls, which are held every 5 years. This year's results ended in a strong showing for the far right across much of the European Union, while many liberals and green parties stumbled. Most of the far-right gains were concentrated in countries that elect large number of seats to the EU Parliament, France, Italy, and Germany. Incoming lawmakers can veto and shape laws, though they cannot introduce them. They also set the EU's budget and approve the selection of the European Commission president, a powerful role currently held by Ursula von der Leyen of the center-right European People's Party. And despite the far-right surge across much of the EU, the European People's Party was the biggest single winner on Sunday, remaining the strongest group in the European Parliament. On Monday, EU chief Ursula von der Leyen spoke in Berlin about the vote.
This election on European soil had two basic messages.
Firstly, there is still a majority in favor of a strong Europe in the center of the political spectrum. In other words, the center has held. But it is also true that the extremes on the left and on the right have gained support. And that is why this result is also associated with a great responsibility for the parties in the center.
The election results triggered a political earthquake in France, where Marine Le Pen's far-right National Rally Party won 30% of the vote, more than double President Emmanuel Macron's Renaissance Party. In a surprise move, President Macron responded by dissolving the French parliament and calling for snap legislative elections in France, which will be held in 3 weeks. In Belgium, the prime minister resigned after his party suffered heavy losses. In Germany, Chancellor Olaf Scholz's Social Democratic Party suffered a crushing defeat, coming in third behind the far-right Alternative for Germany, which scored its best results in history with 16% of the vote. In Italy, Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's far-right Brothers of Italy party surged to first place in Italy, getting nearly 30% of the vote. In Austria, the far-right Freedom Party was also forecast to finish first. For more, we go to London to speak with Mehreen Khan. She's the economics editor at The Times in London and a former Brussels and EU correspondent for The Financial Times. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mehreen. It's great to have you with us. Can you just start off with the overall trend in Europe and then specifically talk about what's happened in France?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on the show, Amy. I'm a big fan. So as you've already mentioned, there have been two major consequences from these elections. One is a drift towards the far right in the composition of the European Parliament, and then this very unexpected political and potentially constitutional crisis in France. To start off with the sort of European landscape, I think it's worth stressing to the listeners and to the audience that having huge surges of one party is quite difficult in the European Parliament because you have 27 elections which are often run on domestic agendas in 27 different countries which are all at different points in their political cycle. But what we can say is that the two biggest member states of the European Union, in France and Germany, there has been a clear shift towards the right, and that's the far right in terms of the AfD, a party which used to be based around Eurosceptic and anti-Euro ideals, but has moved definitively towards anti-migration, anti-Islam, sort of classic populist nativist culture wars in Germany. And similarly, the same has happened among Marine Le Pen with her Front National Party, now known as a Rassemblement National. So they've had a rebranding in recent years to make them seem, I think, a bit more political palatable to French voters. I think on the European scale, immediately nothing will change. And that's because it's very hard in aggregate to get huge swings towards one part of the political spectrum. There is a sort of received wisdom that the centre has held, and that's because the three main parties who made the coalition that supported Ursula von der Leyen in 2019 are still likely to have a majority. But I think looking at the aggregate actually ignores what's going on at a slightly deeper level, and I think more substantive level, where the centre-right parties, the Christian Democrat parties of Europe, led by the likes of the CDU in Germany, have definitely moved towards the space that was occupied by the far right. There's been a clear rightward drift on climate policy, so a backlash against green activism, a clear move towards stronger anti-immigration policies, and a rhetoric around culture wars, around Christianity, around Israel, around foreign policy, the role of European civilization, which means that these formerly centre-right parties are now definitely occupying territory that we used to call that of the far right. So in that sense, the incremental shift of the European parliaments towards the right is not just because of the insurgent far right, but also because of the mainstream parties. And then if we move on to France, I think this is the most unexpected political earthquake to have come from any European elections to have ever held since 1979, which is that they've basically created a domestic political crisis in one of European Union's most important countries, France. And Emmanuel Macron looked at the results and decided that he wanted to confront the far right in quite a binary way, holding an election where most of his rivals have very little time to prepare, to mobilise or to organise. And his bet seems to be that if French voters are given a choice, a very clear choice between his party and Marine Le Pen's far right, that they will choose him. And even if they don't, the possibility of having a far-right prime minister for the next couple of years before the more important presidential election in 2027, he thinks that they will do such a bad job in office that it will become clear to French voters by 2027 that this is a party that is not fit for governance, and this is a party of incompetent, unprofessional cadres, and they're not ready to run France and therefore consolidate his own power base.
And Marine Khan, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the vote, the rise especially of the far-right parties, to what degree the battle over immigration and migrants from the Global South, very much like the United States, where immigration has become a huge issue in the current presidential race, to what degree do you see the potential for these extreme right parties to continue to grow as they try to mobilize their populations against the migrants coming in?
Well, I think there is a clear parallel with the United States, and I would say that parallel is that rather than being a contested area, migration is an area which there is huge amounts of consensus from the left, the right and the far right, that Europe is a continent that is closed, whose borders are closed. I think the push towards having anti-immigration policies, so tough immigration policies that stop people, as you've already mentioned, from the Global South coming in, that this also includes laws around refugees and asylum seekers. The European Union has probably decided since 2015 that it is a continent that does not want these people in its country. So in that sense, the far right has won that argument because it's become a mainstream consensus. I think the areas where the far right has shown a bit more political innovation is moving on to territories like climate change, so creating a culture war around the green transition, saying that this is expensive for ordinary people, that you know, even bordering sometimes on climate denialism. And again, if we think about the United States, there's another parallel, and I think the far-right parties in Europe really do take a lot of cues from Donald Trump's Republican Party, and they've definitely moved into more in the social sphere. So speaking about Europe in civilizational terms, in racial terms, and in religious terms. And this is where I think the far-right probably is finding more appeal among voters, a kind of emotional and identitarian appeal, which does include migration, but isn't definitely broadening out from just being a one-issue subject for the far right. They seem to be a movement, at least, that wants to encompass all areas of policy, from foreign policy, economic policy, and also social and cultural policy.
And how do you assess the failures of the left parties in Europe to gain ground? I mean, there were some which did, but for the most part, they did not.
It's difficult to assess it on an aggregate level, but if we think about some small pockets, so there have been surprise successes in the Netherlands, where the Greens and the Socials and the Social Democrats, the traditional left, actually teamed up and they did well. They became the first party in the Netherlands, second to the far-right party of Geert Wilders. But generally, the left has struggled to find a message, and in particular, an economic message for populations in Europe that have basically seen stagnant wage growth, a cost of living crisis, very high energy prices. And I think, crucially, they've also failed to get that sort of emotional appeal, something that the far right seem to do far better, creating narratives around identity, around people's place in their member states, in their countries, their relationships to their governments and to each other. It's worth noting that if the UK had been a member state in the European Union, this is the first time that Britain was not participating in a European election, the left would have done pretty well, because Labour probably would have had a stonking huge vote swing in their favour, and then we would probably be talking about a Social Democrat grouping in the European Parliament that was close to the biggest, the EPP. So there are lots of variables involved, but I think you're right, that generally the left has failed to beat the far right because they've been outflanked on so many areas, including traditional strengths, which they would have seen, like creating social and economic justice and providing a sense of inclusivity and diversity. These messages have either not been pushed far enough in countries like France or have been seen to be, you know, too beyond the pale for, I think, a population in many Western European countries where there is just a very general and long-term trend towards the right.
Marie Khan, for people, especially in the United States, who may not really understand the way Europe works with the European Parliament, if you can explain its role, its power, how significant it is, and also back in France, who Marine Le Pen is.
Sure. It's the European Parliament is one of the three major bodies of the European Union. Its executive is called the European Commission. Then there is a collection of the member states, so the heads of all of the 27 governments known as the European Council. And then there is the European Parliament, which is supposed to be the democratic hub of the European Union. They have the ability to veto legislation, which is proposed by the European Commission. They also negotiate on legislation. Generally, the European Parliament has been held together by a grand coalition, a coalition between the centre-left and the centre-right. That has persisted. It persisted all the way through the Parliament until 2019, when Liberals had to be brought in to support the coalition. We think the Liberals and the Greens are also going to be brought in to support a coalition behind the President of the European Commission. And it's very important for her. We think it's going to be Ursula von der Leyen again to have this support, because it means that having a majority means that she can pass proposed legislation through the Parliament, even after, you know, there have been tweaks and made. The European Parliament, however, is seen to be probably the weakest of those three institutions that I've already mentioned. That's because they're usually divided. It's quite difficult to mobilise the European Parliament as a singular force, because it's becoming much more fractured. And we know that now, because we have a far left and increasingly large far right who will try and disrupt the process of legislation in the European Union. And if we're thinking about France, for your listeners in the US, I'm trying to think of a parallel to Marine Le Pen in the US. I don't think there is a clear one, but she has been the face, and I think the acceptable face, of the far right in France for about 10 years. She took over a party called the Front National from her father, which, when he was in charge, Jean-Marie Le Pen, it was a far more anti-Semitic, far more overtly racist party. It's been the job of Marine Le Pen to create a softer image around the Front National. However, they're still considered to be the far right, despite dropping, I think, some of the anti-Semitism. They've definitely been moving into areas like Islamophobia. They are an incredibly anti-Muslim party. They speak, and Marine Le Pen has said that the sight of Muslims praying on the streets was the equivalent to the Nazi occupation of France in the 1930s. This is still a party that is considered to be beyond the pale, or had been considered to be beyond the pale by mainstream parties. But as we're probably going to see in the next 3 weeks, there is now a chance for the first time in French history that the Parliament and the Prime Minister will be from the far-right party. And this is a prelude to the potential of having a far-right French president in 2027.
Finally, we just have 30 seconds, Mehreen. The role of Israel's war on Gaza in these various elections?
European Union countries are usually split on the issue of Israel, and often that's not a partisan thing. It's about historical ties towards Palestine. One thing that I will note, is we don't have too much time, is that before these elections, there was a lot of talk and discourse around Brussels that Vladimir Putin would be very happy if there was a far-right insurgency in Europe. We haven't heard too much from Putin, but what we have heard is that the Israeli government, led by Benjamin Netanyahu, has already expressed that they are very happy with this outcome of a far-right insurgency, because they think this will protect Israel from criticism among European Union member states. And I think that is a pretty decent bet on his part. I think that is true. I think criticism of Israel will become much more difficult in the European Union, because far-right parties are very closely aligned to what they think of their spiritual partner in Israel, and particularly the figure of Benjamin Netanyahu.
Mehreen Khan, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Now economics editor at The Times of London, former Brussels and EU correspondent for The Financial Times. Next up, we speak to Dr. James Smith. He's in Istanbul today. He's an emergency medical doctor who just left Gaza after 2 months. Back in 20 seconds.
Thank you. Cheers.
Safe and Sound by the French duo Justice. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In Gaza, the healthcare system's barely functioning 8 months into Israel's devastating assault. In a statement Monday, Gaza's health ministry warned the few remaining hospitals still partially functioning could completely shut down if diesel generators needed for electricity are not replaced or maintained soon. The ministry said it expected a number of generators at hospitals to fail because Israel's preventing the entry of necessary spare parts. Health facilities that supply things like oxygen and refrigeration for medicine are facing a complete shutdown, which the health ministry said in a statement, quote, means certain death for the sick and injured and the complete end of health services, end quote. In addition to severe shortages of electricity, medical supplies and equipment as a result of the Israeli blockade, Gaza's hospitals have been hit by Israeli airstrikes repeatedly over the last 8 months. The World Health Organization said this week, since October 7th, there have been more than 460 Israeli attacks on Gaza's healthcare system, affecting over 100 health facilities. More than 37,000 Palestinians people have been wounded. For more, we're joined by Dr. James Smith, emergency medical doctor just back from Gaza, spent nearly 2 months there treating patients at trauma stabilization points in Al-Mawasi and Rafah. Also worked in the emergency rooms of Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah and Al-Awda Hospital in Nusayrat. He left Gaza Friday. He joins us today. We welcome you to Democracy Now! If you can start off, Dr. Smith, you have left, particularly after the attack on Nusayrat, which was considered the worst killing in 6 months, over 270 Palestinians killed this weekend. So many of them were brought to, so many others who were injured, it's believed something like 700, brought to the hospital where you work, to Al-Aqsa.
Thanks, Amy. The situation in Gaza and certainly in the middle area of Gaza where I was working up until the 5th of June remains catastrophic. The intensity of violence that Israel has meted out against the Palestinian people, the barbarity of it all, continues to, you know, you feel that you've seen the absolute worst, and the very next day it gets worse again. The massacre in Nusayrat on Saturday was certainly the worst of the violence that those neighborhoods have seen since the start of the genocide back in the beginning of October. 274 dead, killed rather, as you've mentioned, approximately 700 injured. I would expect that in the coming days we will hear of more people who have died, who have succumbed to injuries that were sustained as a result of Israeli airstrikes and the Israeli ground incursion in that area, as a result of the collapsed healthcare system. As you mentioned, there are no fully functional hospitals any longer in Gaza, and no health facilities that are able to absorb the sheer scale of need now.
And Dr. Smith, your second trip now to Gaza, this one lasted nearly 2 months. Could you talk about how conditions changed over that period of time? Has there been any improvement in the arrival of supplies to these hospitals or the food situation? Give us a sense of what you saw.
So to be absolutely clear, the situation deteriorates day on day. This is the sort of fallacy of humanitarian access or the veneer of a humanitarian system. There is no improvement in any conditions in Gaza. This overfixation on the number of trucks that are entering into Gaza, or rather the number of trucks that the Israeli state has permitted to enter into Gaza, is a distraction from the violence and its many manifestations. nations. We have almost the entire population of the Gaza Strip now forcibly displaced. The majority of those people no longer have homes to return to. Entire cities, and I have seen them myself, Khan Yunis, Gaza City, other neighborhoods, parts of Rafah now, that have been completely destroyed. Homes, schools, clinics that have been vaporized to dust, concrete, and sand. There has been absolutely no improvement in any of the basic conditions that are required to sustain human life in Gaza at the present time.
And how are you able to even administer, especially for those who are who require emergency surgery of the wounded who come in? Talk to us about your direct experience with these kinds of this kind of medical support.
Perhaps if I speak to you about my last day in Gaza at Al-Aqsa Hospital on the 5th of June. So I was working in the emergency room that day. We had several electricity blackouts during that time. We were treating patients on the floor of the emergency room by torchlight. We had one young boy who came into the ER with an open femoral fracture, bleeding profusely from his left upper leg. Very, very severe injury. He had been injured as a result of an Israeli airstrike. The orthopedic surgeon, a junior doctor, very competent, but nevertheless still a junior doctor, came down to treat him and without any anesthesia, because there wasn't any, had to pull and splint his leg in order to stabilize him and to sustain his life long enough to get him into the OR. The hospital now has five ORs, but you have a surgical team or several surgical teams that are working 24/7. There is no rest for the surgeons in these hospitals and the scrub nurses working alongside them. Phenomenally difficult conditions. We have an emergency team that are, frankly, the most dedicated doctors, nurses, and allied health professionals that I have ever had the privilege of working with. But the conditions in which they are working were unsustainable 8 months ago. Now it is just a testament to the sheer determination of the Palestinian people and the desire of Palestinian healthcare workers to administer care to the Palestinian people that these hospitals are able to function in any way whatsoever.
Smith, you've been talking about the effects of the bombing of people who survive and being brought into the hospital. What about the issue of hunger? UNICEF just came out with a report saying 9 out of 10 children in the Gaza Strip are experiencing severe food shortages. If you can talk about what that means and that how that affects them long term if they survive, and also the lack of clean water and drinking sewage water. Leading to diseases like, for example, cholera.
So hunger is rife across the Gaza Strip. There is a fixation of sorts among epidemiologists and distant public health experts in the terms of malnutrition. But hunger is rife. As I've mentioned already, Israel maintains complete control over what and who enters into and out of Gaza. They are able to manufacture the conditions of life, or rather of death, in Gaza. And they have complete control over how much food aid or how much food enters into Gaza. In my final weeks in Gaza, I was struck that commercial trucks from Israel were given precedence of access over the humanitarian aid trucks. So in the south of Gaza, we saw several markets in which there were several fresh fruit and fresh vegetable commodities bearing the slogans of Israeli companies, but very limited food aid that was able to enter into Gaza. On several occasions, the big UN agencies said that they would have to stop food aid distributions. It was incredible to me that the very state that was starving people and inflicting such violence upon them was then bringing in food that, of course, people can't afford to buy anymore, and that people, those who could, were having to pay for food from, as I say, the very state, the very economy that is trying to strangle the Palestinian people. To your other point about access to clean water, sanitary conditions, the smell of sewage was rife throughout. From Rafah to Khan Yunis and into Gaza City, several instances of sewage overflowing onto the street. In all of the locations I worked across Gaza and all of the hospitals I visited, including in the north of Gaza and Gaza City, we saw patients who were suffering from very severe bouts of acute watery diarrhea, a major outbreak of of access to nutritious food, the impact of a lack of clean drinkable water on physical health is catastrophic. It will certainly have a major impact on all those people who are suffering as a result of other health or trauma-related problems as well.
Juan, we're not able to hear you.
Dr. Smith, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah.
Yes, I can hear you.
You mentioned that you traveled all around the different parts of Gaza. Did you have any interactions at all with the Israeli Defense Forces? Did they enter into the hospitals, or did you have any interactions with them at checkpoints?
We had to pass via the checkpoints that the Israelis have constructed that have now severed across the north and south of Gaza from the east to the west. We interacted with the Israeli occupation forces during those movements. They were incredibly frightening experiences. During one of those convoy movements, one of the Palestinian drivers that was working for a UN agency was detained, stripped naked, and taken away by the Israeli occupation forces. Very, very frightening, very unpleasant. And yes, I saw and have heard stories of incredibly horrific encounters between the Israeli ground forces at those checkpoints and the Palestinian people, some of whom are still trying to move from north to south.
And finally, doctors who have died. We interviewed Dr. Hamam Alo months ago, who was, when I asked him why he didn't leave as he talked about the intense bombing, he said he didn't get his medical degree to desert his patients. He went home to help his family, and his house was bombed. You then have Dr. Adnan Albersh, head of orthopedics at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, who was arrested and died in an Israeli prison. As we wrap up, Dr. Smith, as you leave Gaza after 2 months, what about the doctors being imprisoned, doctors and nurses and staff being killed?
These are all the most egregious and horrific war crimes. And as I've mentioned, it was phenomenal to see the determination of my Palestinian colleagues who will not abandon the Palestinian people or Palestine at this most horrific moment in their history. It's tragic, beyond tragic, that so many Palestinian healthcare workers, that so many Palestinians have been killed during the course of this ongoing genocide. And it's even more horrific that this violence is allowed to continue.
Dr. James Smith, we thank you for being with us. In 20 seconds, the UN Security Council has just passed a resolution put forward by the U.S. for a ceasefire. Hamas has just accepted. U.S. said Israel was accepting, though Netanyahu has said other things about that. Your message to the world?
I think I said this back in January when I spoke to you, Amy. The violence must end. And once the violence has ended, the real work of the pursuit of peace and justice for the Palestinian people must continue.
Dr. James Smith, emergency room doctor just out of Gaza, spent nearly 2 months in Gaza treating patients at trauma stabilization points in El Mawasi and Rafah, also worked in emergency rooms at Al-Aqsa and Al-Auda Hospital in Nusayrat. He was speaking to us from Istanbul, Turkey. We'll be joined next by a Jewish-American Army major named Harrison Mann. He's the first military and intelligence officer to publicly resign over President Biden's support for Israel's war on Gaza. Back in 20 seconds. Just hold on until the morning. Promise me we'll make it home. Can anybody? Just wanna be free. We just wanna be free. We just wanna be free. We just wanna be free. And this will be the moment. Oh. We just wanna be free. By Palestinian-American artist Zach Matari. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with the first military and intelligence officer to publicly resign over the Biden administration's support for Israel's war on Gaza. Jewish-American Army Major Harrison Mann resigned from his role at the Defense Intelligence Agency after a 13-year career. The DIA is essentially the Pentagon's CIA. In a letter explaining his resignation he posted online last month, Mann wrote, quote, "This office does not only inform policy, it facilitates and at times directly executes policy. And the policy that's never been far from my mind for the past 6 months is the nearly unqualified support for the government of Israel, which has enabled and empowered the killing and starvation of tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians. As we were recently reminded, this unconditional support also encourages reckless escalation that risks wider war," he wrote. Mann submitted his resignation November 1st, just over 3 weeks into Israel's assault on Gaza. His separation from the military became effective last week. Harrison Mann joins us now from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now! Harrison, if you can go back to November and talk about what drove you to decide to separate from the U.S. military. You're a U.S. Army major who worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency. And explain exactly what your role was and what the DIA does.
Yes, and thank you for having me. So just in terms of what I was seeing, what drove my decision back in October is even in the first weeks after October 7th, with the start of the Israeli air campaign on Gaza, it was really clear that they were prepared to inflict huge numbers of civilian casualties, which they did, and which are, you know, a trend your last guest described in really heartbreaking detail. So there's very high tolerance and willingness to inflict civilian casualties, which we already saw. We already saw the autoimmune response from U.S. and Israeli adversaries or Iranian proxies in the region. With, I think, the first Houthi attacks starting in mid-October. And really, beyond those risks and the humanitarian cost, it was really clear, both at the national level and from what I was hearing from the senior leadership in my community, that our support for Israel was going to be really unshakable and unconditional, no matter how many people they killed and how they conducted the war. And my job at the time was assistant to the director of basically the Middle East and Africa office for the agency, who was also the official who oversaw the Israel crisis response. So I was very well placed to understand some of the higher level discussions happening about the war and about U.S. support to the war. And that really left me feeling hopeless that we were going to condition or moderate our aid or our support in any way.
Yeah, Harrison Mann, I'm wondering if you could talk about, from the perspective of what the Defense Intelligence Agency, the kind of information it was collecting, even before the events of October 7th and this new war, To your knowledge, has there ever been a situation like Gaza where basically people were in an open-air prison where the Israelis essentially controlled all ingress and egress from the territory and were able to cut off any kind of contact with the outside world whenever they wanted to?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly been other conflicts, including in our region, where other forces did some level of siege or cut off access to the population they were attacking. And I think the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen against the Houthis, which until recently had wound down, was probably the next closest example of a man-made humanitarian crisis cutting off the entry of food and medication while bombing a population.
And in terms of what were the, why you decided specifically in the first few weeks as the conflict began to resign, what were the main reasons that you felt you had to resign?
I mean, fundamentally, I understood that every day that I was going to go into the office, I was going to be contributing to the Israeli campaign. That was something that DOD was supporting. It's something that DIA was supporting. And I think it's open that we have a very close intelligence relationship with Israel. And so I was tangentially involved in that. And I kind of got more and more discouraged and hopeless that we were going to stop. The U.S. was going to stop its support. And I understood early on and was unfortunately validated in this that nobody was going to come tell me to stop. Nobody at any level in my chain of command, even people who I think were sympathetic to what was happening to the Palestinians, was going to ask me or anybody I worked with to reconsider the support that we were facilitating.
Harrison Mann, you're an American Jew, as well as an Army major working at the DIA. How did your Jewish background influence your decision?
My Jewish background, you know, influenced both my service and my decision to leave. I have a very distinct memory of several years ago going to the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial Museum in Israel on a trip that was actually sponsored and hosted by the IDF, and you go through that museum and you see all these sites of the Holocaust victims, and then at the end there's this giant blow up photo that I think is still there, showing a lot of U.S. Army soldiers interspersed with Holocaust camp survivors, and they're attending a service led by a U.S. Army rabbi after their camp has been liberated, and that, I think, seeing that photo, which I hadn't seen before, was like one of my proudest moments of my service, understanding that I got to wear the same uniform and be in the same army as the men who liberated that camp. And today, seeing photos of charred bodies and burnt corpses and starved, emaciated children that are from, you know, 2023, 2024, not the 40s. It's impossible not to make that connection. And I guess it forced me to realize that that's what I was contributing to in the same uniform, instead of saving those people. And so I think the situations are not perfectly analogous, but the moral logic was very clear to me because I'm Jewish.
I wanted to ask you about more recent events like this weekend and as your role as a DIA officer, if you could explain what's really going on here. Talking about the role of U.S. intelligence support in Israel's war in Gaza. This is National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan speaking on CNN from Paris.
The United States has been providing support to Israel for several months in its efforts to help identify the locations of hostages in Gaza and to support efforts to try to secure their rescue or recovery. I'm not going to get into the specific operational or intelligence-related matters associated with that because we need to protect those. I can only just say that we have generally provided support to the IDF so that we can try to get all of the hostages home, including the American hostages who are still being held.
So I understand that intelligence, U.S. intelligence assisted, but will you say anything about U.S. personnel, U.S. weapons?
Well, the one thing I can say is that there were no U.S. forces, no U.S. boots on the ground involved in this operation. We did not participate militarily in this operation.
So no boots on the ground, Jake Sullivan says to Dana Bash of CNN. He's talking about this weekend when more than 270 Palestinians were killed in the Israeli military operation that freed four Israeli hostages in Nusayrat in Gaza. Israeli intelligence officials told The New York Times, this is in an article today, that U.S. military officials in Israel provided some of the intelligence about the hostages rescued on Saturday. According to The Times, the Pentagon and the CIA have been providing information collected from drone flights over Gaza, communications intercepts, and other sources about the potential location of hostages. While Israel has its own intelligence, the United States and Britain have been able to provide intelligence from the air and cyberspace that Israel cannot collect on its own, The New York Times reports. So, Harrison Mann, talk more about this and what kind of support was, it looks like, provided this weekend, and then go more generally into, well, President Biden more recently said he's approving $1 billion more of just outright weapons to Israel.
Yeah, I think the operation this weekend is a kind of unusually public example of the value of intelligence support that the U.S. provides to Israel. Which is, you know, we've had a longstanding and very strong relationship, and usually it's not discussed. But I think this weekend we saw how intel support, even if it's for a goal that I think is nominally, quite something that's difficult to dispute, which is rescuing hostages, can nonetheless contribute to operations that kill what looks like a very large number of civilians. And I think it's also indicative of the value of the intel support that we give Israel. And I just highlight that because that's the area that I worked in or adjacent to. And it's another form of valuable support that we give Israel that helps them prosecute this war. And it's another less discussed form of leverage that we also have over the Israeli government.
And Harrison, man, I'm wondering your moral concerns about what was going on in Gaza, to what extent you shared it with other fellow military or defense intelligence people, and what advice you would have to those in the military or in the intelligence community that are still grappling with their ethical concerns.
So for the first months after I initiated my resignation process, which did not actually conclude until last week, I was really kind of afraid. I didn't feel comfortable talking about this with anybody because nobody else was discussing it, and it felt like it was way outside of our norms and outside of what would be culturally acceptable where I worked. But in April, when I finally shared my resignation letter with my office, I got really overwhelmingly positive and supportive feedback from the people that I worked with. And I discovered that there were a lot of people who felt pretty much the same way that I did and also felt like they could not openly discuss their concerns. And since I've publicized my letter, more people from both my office and elsewhere in the Department of Defense and the military have also reached out. And, you know, my number one piece of advice or kind of tough love here is understanding, again, that nobody is going to tell you to stop. I do not think we are near an end to this conflict, and so you are nowhere near the end of being finally told that you can stop participating in it. And so understanding that, you then have to realize that moderating your level of support or participation is a choice, the same way that going to work tomorrow and continuing to support the Israeli campaign is a choice. And I know that what I did is not feasible for a lot of people. I understand that. I know other folks in our line of work who have asked for a transfer or who have asked their supervisor, hey, I'm going to keep doing all of the portfolios you give me, but find somebody else for Israel. I think another possibly effective option is asking for an assurance in writing that what you're doing is both legal and consistent with your organization's ethical standards and value statements. That's something I wish I had done, which I think would have given some people pause, because we're asking each other, we're asking our subordinates to do a lot of these things and contribute to this conflict without really pausing to think about the ethical dimension. And that's something I'm guilty of as well.
Harrison, man,
Go ahead. I would just finally say, if you can't do that, just start talking about it and letting somebody that you work with know that they're not alone might be incredibly valuable in and of itself.
We just have 10 seconds. What effect did the protests have on you? Do they make it inside?
The campus protests?
Yes.
It was further indication about whether or not I was on the right side of history and, you know, how I'd be able to look back at this years from now, which is what helped drive my decision.
Harrison Mann, Jewish American, U.S. Army major, recently resigned from the Defense Intelligence Agency over the Biden administration's policy in Gaza. That does it for our show. To see others who have resigned our interviews, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
You are listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh and online at WRCT.org.
Rise above, we're gonna rise above. I am gonna have my chance.
With petition. After philosophy, is your life worth the painting? Is this girl versus boy with different symbol? Being born is power. Scout leader, not detect this big sin. Your risk chains me hostage. Me, I'm fighting with my head. I'm not ambiguous. I must look like a dork. Me, naked with textbooks. So dig this big crux. Organizing the Boy Scouts for murder is wrong. 10 years beyond a big sweat point. Man, it was still there ever without you. Coming back around, look, we're coming together for just a second. A peek, a guess. At the wholeness, it's way too big. At the wholeness, it's way too big.